But I am glad that you're here this evening. As I said this morning, and the last time that we met on Sunday evening,
last year.
We were talking about traditions like Thanksgiving and then Advent and Christmas traditions. And the suggestion was made that perhaps we continue to talk about traditions. Why do we do certain things the way we do, and why do other people do them differently? So that's kind of, at least as long as you have an interest in that, that's kind of where we're headed over the next several weeks, to look at different traditions. Why do we do them as Baptists, and not all Baptists do them the same way? Do's them the same way. Not all Baptists.
Before you move on, was I saying
yesterday? Sure.
Jehovah's Witness, you know, they don't celebrate Christmas.
No. They don't celebrate.
They'll go buy the toys and stuff and give it to their kids later.
Well, they don't celebrate Christmas. They don't celebrate birthdays per se. They recognize birthdays, but they don't celebrate them because part of that is because birthdays and all that considered their man, quote unquote, man-made celebrations and remembrances. As far as Christmas is concerned, the Jehovah's Witnesses, among other things, they recognize that December 25th was not the actual day on which Jesus was born, and so that is a big no-no to celebrate at a different time, or to celebrate at a time that it really didn't happen. Also, within Jehovah's Witnesses, while there is, Jesus does have some importance, Jesus is not an equal part of the Godhead. And so, with God the Father. And so, you know, no on Christmas, no on birthdays, the do not pledge allegiance to the flag, those kinds of things as well. And everything is Jehovah God. Although, you know, we've got some friends that are Jehovah's Witnesses that I try to be really careful with them, not wanting to turn them off. We haven't gotten to the discussions yet, and we've known them for several years, but haven't gotten to the discussions yet about how Jehovah is not a naturally occurring word in the Bible. It's a mixture of the vowel pointings for Adonai and the consonants for Yahweh. But Jehovah as a specific word in the Hebrew text does not occur anywhere in the Old Testament.
So they're not Christian.
But there are people, they would claim they are, but most folks would say no. Just like with Mormons. Christ has a physical body. He is Son of God in a physical way, but he did come to die. But at the same time, he is not an equal part of the Godhead. He was elevated to his status beneath God the Father, and sitting alongside God the Father because of his obedient action.
So they say not God in the flesh.
No. Well, it's there, and at the end of time, there is, in some Jehovah's Witness teaching, there is a sense that, you know, Jesus will come back and be a part of all of that and a part of the judgment and those kinds of things, and leading in the battle of Armageddon. But then again, according to some branches of Islam, Jesus will come back. Jesus is called Messiah, Word of God, Spirit of God, and in some branches of Islam, Jesus will come back, and it is Jesus who will judge with God the Father, not Muhammad.
Do they celebrate
Easter? They will recognize what Jesus did at Easter, but you will not find them having an Easter celebration.
They believe in the resurrection.
No. With the crucifixion and the resurrection, that's not something that they celebrate and that they emphasize. Jesus did come. Jesus was crucified. Jesus was raised by God, but Jesus is not God in the flesh, God incarnate, not a part of the Godhead, not equal with God, in spite of what some of Paul's writings say and those kinds of things.
Yeah. Right. Guy I worked with, they'd go the next day and get toys. Well, they'd have them, but they'd give them to them the day after. because our little kids had them, you know.
Right. Well, you know, and it's...
Well, Thursday, you give it to her. The next day after her birthday, well, I asked him, I said, what's the difference?
Well, but it's not tied to the specific celebration as such, which is a man-made kind of thing. But it's kind of like we have a person who in our town hall community who's really a major problem, but she claims that she's a single Muslim mother and all this kind of stuff, and she's a good Muslim and strong Muslim. She's originally from Turkey. Her family moved here when she was a child. And yet she's divorced two husbands. Oh. Wait a minute. Muslim women don't divorce. But anyway, she's divorced two husbands. She decorates for Halloween. She decorates for Christmas and has for several years. And her son goes to Christmas parties. He's just now entering middle school. Someone questioned her a couple of years ago about that. She said, well, I do it for my son.
She got Western.
That's not even a good excuse.
But she's Jehovah's.
No, she's Muslim. What's really interesting is several years, well, when 9/11 happened, one of the board members was living there in a townhouse, and her husband put an American flag over their bedroom window. And she went to the person who at the time was the HOA president and told him, she demanded that he go tell them to take it down because it offended her. Even though she graduated from high school she graduated from Wade Hampton High School, she graduated from college in the upstate. It offended her. The funny thing now is she flies a little American flag in her front flower bed.
I guess that she just take them to the island. But, I wish more of them did that way.
Well, but she's on Social Security disability. Anyway. Sorry, Ken, I shut that off while I gave a little explanation. So, anyway, traditions. But they don't do that. In fact, recently our friend's youngest daughter had a birthday, and we happened to see her out somewhere, and I said to her, I'm glad that you're a year older. She said, thank you, because I didn't say happy birthday, because a couple of years ago we were somewhere and saw her and somebody wished her happy birthday. And she said, thanks, but we don't celebrate them. So.
What would that have to do with anything when you celebrate a birthday or not?
The emphasis is on you and not Jehovah and all that kind of stuff. I'm just glad God let me live another, another year and another day, you know.
But. Yeah, it'll be on your birthday.
Boy, I tell you what, my family better not forget mine.
I'll forget theirs.
Traditions. Traditions. Tradition. If I were a rich man. Yeah. Every time I think about traditions, I think about Fiddler on the Roof and Tevye. But traditions. What are traditions? If you were to define tradition, what would you say?
It's got a history. Ongoing habits.
Okay. It's got a history.
So long that people don't know how they originate, why they're still around. Almost like feuds in a way.
Well, sometimes they are ongoing things that people don't. When did it start? Why did it start? Why are the Hatfields and the McCoys? You know, they've made up now.
Yeah.
That was on a History Channel special last year. They've made up. Well, if you go to dictionary and you look it up, you'll find under tradition a way of thinking, an inherited, established, or customary pattern of thought, action, or behavior, as in a religious practice or a social custom. A belief or story or a body of beliefs or stories relating to the past that are commonly accepted as historical, though not necessarily verifiable. In other words, historical, but you can't necessarily verify them, but we do it because we've been telling the history, and the history says this for all this time.
Yeah, you were talking about that lady a while ago who came and got un-Muslimized with a divorce and everything else. You see a lot of movies, I think of my big fat Greek wedding for one, how the father always plans for the daughter to marry,
right,
that and everything
right.
else, and when they come to America,
Well, some are.
And those old country traditions do die out.
Well, and that's true. The first husband, well, both husbands were from the Middle East. Her first husband we never saw very much, except to come out and smoke. He had long beard and long hair, and he disappeared, and nobody knows where. Second one was married to her for 3 years, and he disappeared 3 summers ago. No, he drove off in a Mercedes SUV that she got after she got the disability. But, you know, but these things that are handed down. Another, the handing down of information, beliefs, and customs by word of mouth or by example from one generation to another. So traditions, things that we do, and we may or may not necessarily be able to verify when they started, how they started, all that kind of stuff. But those traditions, and we all have traditions, do we not? Some of them are religious and some of them are not. I mean, the tradition, where did the tradition start? And I really don't know. But I promise you, if I went back and played softball or baseball again, I would step over the line. You don't step on the baseline.
No, it's superstition that tradition got hand-to-hand.
Right. You step on the baseline, it's bad luck. So you step over. And the tradition, and the traditions that we develop as individuals. You put on your uniform exactly the same way every time. The same sock on that foot goes first and the other one second and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, so we all have those traditions. Although sometimes they seem to be becoming less important today to a lot of folks, especially younger generations. Well, religious traditions especially seem to be becoming less important to many. But I would submit to you that remembering and observing traditions not only can be a source of good and happy times, whether it's Christmas, Thanksgiving, nobody wears Easter bonnets anymore except little kids, and folks in the African-American church. You go to an African-American church on Easter Sunday, I promise you, you will have 100% hats and bonnets on. The women and the men. Right, and the men will have their fedora or their Stetson or whatever when they come in. Absolutely, usually they will. Easter bonnets and Easter baskets. But what do traditions do? Right? What do traditions do for us? They give us moorings, do they not? Moorings, MORRINGS. They give us anchors or foundations to help us understand from where we have come and to guide us toward another destination. So examining traditions can sometimes help us to understand why we do what we do, what we might see as essential, and what becomes peripheral, and how we may have moved away from the tradition sometimes, the moorings. And then we have the opportunity to think about what others observe as well. My friend Bill Leonard, former dean of the School of Divinity at Wake Forest University, and Bill's an internationally known scholar in church history, and in particular in American Christianity. Bill and his family, when he taught at Samford and they moved to Alabama, with a lot of the wars and things that had been going on in some Baptist circles, they decided to search around. And he eventually said to his pastor one day, he said, you know when I miss church and my family's not here. And the preacher said, yeah, I can tell when you're not. He and his family joined an African-American church. They were the only white people in the church. So it was pretty obvious when they weren't there. And when they moved to Winston-Salem, they didn't seek out an Anglo church. They sought a black church and became members there. But Bill opens his book, Baptist Ways of History, in the preface with the following statement. I quote, "The thesis of this book is relatively simple. It suggests that amid certain distinctives, Baptists Baptist identity is configured in a variety of ways by groups, subgroups, and individuals who claim the Baptist name. This identity extends across a theological spectrum from Arminian to Calvinist, from conservative to liberal, from open to closed communionists, and from denominationalist to independent. It surveys basic beliefs, events, and experiences evident in Baptist communities. What does it mean to be Baptist? What is the nature of the Baptist role in church and society? At a time when much Baptist identity worldwide is in a state of permanent transition, it is important that we understand something of the diversity and continuity of Baptist life in the initial years of the movements. In other words, we need to look at the development of the traditions. End of quote. And what we find, unfortunately, as he says later on in his opening, in a sense, Baptists created an ecclesiastical and theological framework that ensured controversy, dispute, and division. Because when you start looking even at Baptists and say, what do Baptists believe and what do Baptists practice? You've got Arminian to Calvinist. Calvinist predestination, Arminian's free will. You've got independents, staunchly independent, and then you've got people that come together in denominations. You got people who say, anyone who is a believer, a baptized believer, can participate in communion. And you got folks that say, if you're not a member of this church, you cannot. Even if you're another Baptist. Not this church, but they'll say in their church, if you're not a member of this particular church you're in today. Yeah, closed communion. So, where to start? Where to start? Well, if we look at, and why are traditions important? If you look at Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 1, even the Old Testament, Moses says, and now, O Israel, give heed to the statutes and the ordinances which I teach you, and do them that you may live and go in and take possession of the land which the Lord, the God of your fathers, gives to you. You shall not add to the word which I command you, nor take away from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you. In Deuteronomy 6, we often hear this passage quoted or paraphrased. Now, this is the commandment, the statutes and the ordinances which the Lord your God commanded me to teach you, that you may do them in the land to which you are going over to possess it, that you may fear the Lord your God, you and your son's son, by keeping all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. Keeping the traditions alive. Keeping the statutes alive, keeping the ordinances and commandments alive. Ed's favorite guy to sometimes like, but most of the time not. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 14 and 15 in the New Testament. Let's see, 2:14 and 15 says, to this he called you through our gospel so that you may obtain the glory of our Lord Jesus Christ. So then, stand firm and hold to the traditions which you were taught by us, either by word of mouth or by letter. So within life, traditions are important, but especially within religion. And in Judaism and Christianity, both traditions were extremely important to keep those things going, because they gave moorings, they gave foundations, they gave anchor points to help people understand. When the children of Israel go to cross the Jordan River, and God says to Joshua, get one man from each of the tribes, and as the Ark of the Covenant, as the priests and Levites' toes touch the water with the Ark of the Covenant, the water will part and have that man chosen pick up a large stone. And when you get to the other side, he says, build an altar of those unhewn stones. By the way, unhewn stones were very important. Difference in an unhewn stone and a hewn stone is man-made. Therefore, people take pride in the hewn stone and the altar built from it. The Canaanites and others did that. God said, no, unhewn stones. Why? It reminds them that God is a creator. He said, do this and build this altar and sacrifice And then he said, so that in the future, when your children and your children's children and your children's children's children ask, what do these stones mean? Then you may teach them and tell them, the Lord our God parted the waters and gave us this land, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So those traditions were important. So where do we start? Paul Harrison writes, it is clear that Baptist history is freighted with ambiguity, and those who strive to establish the singularity of the tradition are on a weak foundation. End of quote. But that doesn't mean that we should simply just rock along with things and say, well, we'll just go with the flow. We're Baptists, we can do whatever. And it doesn't matter. I would say when conventions and missions boards and churches encourage leaving out any real reference to Baptist identity, then there's a legitimate concern about whether they're being Baptist or not. In recent years, as you may be aware, should be aware, in recent years there have been suggestions by mission boards, when you go out and you plant churches, do not put Baptist in the name. Why? Because we air our laundry in public. Not just clean, but dirty. And Southern Baptists have tended to beat each other up in public. Well, not just Southern Baptists, other Baptists as well. Leadership. The convention, SBC, a few years ago, voted on a resolution that people not do that. And then later, one of the boards suggested that churches who currently had Baptist in their name might consider removing it from their signs, so that it wouldn't turn people off.
Where are you going to put it?
Well, the most popular nomenclature these days is community church. The majority of community churches that have been started in the last 10 years or so were started by Southern Baptists.
We got a community church right there at Crossroads.
Marathon. Yeah. Marathon is a Southern Baptist church. You would not know that unless you specifically asked and they told you, or in transferring a letter, you get a letter back from their church that says, so-and-so is united with us. This happened several years ago. We had someone who actually lived more that way and went there and said, the last line, please send this letter, we are a Southern Baptist congregation. But you don't find it in, it doesn't say Marathon Baptist Church. It's placed down on 81 with all the campuses. If you look at their statements of faith and the things by which they go, they're Baptist up one side and down the other. Yet one of their leaders about 5 years ago, I can say, I'm glad I did not have this person in class when I taught at Anderson, but one of their leaders said, we're non-denominational, and when pushed further by a reporter said, well, we do a lot of things like Baptist, but we don't want to tell people, and we don't want them to think that we're Baptist. That's the same person when asked about why there are no pictures of Jesus anywhere or the Holy Family anywhere in the church. He said, because it would be a distraction to the worshipers. Direct quote. They would be a distraction to the worshipers. So Baptists do all kinds of things. And I'm not suggesting that we give up freedom as Baptists. I would not suggest that at all. Freedom to be and to worship as we are led, because that in itself would be un-Baptist. Baptists have fought, and in early Baptist documents, as well as other Baptist documents, Baptists fought for the right for anyone to be Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, Catholic, Jewish, heretic, anything else. Our Baptist forebears, many of them died so that we would have that freedom, not only for us, but the freedom for others as well. But if we are going to be Baptist, we should understand what that entails, I think, especially in an historical way, to try and understand why did we get to this point? How did we get to this point? Why do different denominations practice things differently? And why do different Baptists do them as well? This Baptist church right here does things differently from Baptist Church on Highway 20 on the other side of the toll road. Different from Baptist Church across the river that came out of this church. And on we could go. And they do things differently from us. So, what are some of the topics that I hope we will talk about? Just a few. What about Baptists in the Scriptures? Baptists in the Bible. All Baptists affirm an abiding belief in the authority of Scripture found in the Old and New Testaments. All Baptists do. But many disagree on the nature of biblical authority. Not all Baptists and not all Baptist churches hold the same level or the same ideas on biblical authority. Most are divided over theories of inspiration. Verbal plenary to dynamic and all kinds of points in between. Dictation theory. A lot of Baptists are divided over doctrines of inerrancy. This is one of the things, it may come up again later, but one of the things a number of years ago in some of the quote-unquote wars that were going on within the convention, and some of the leadership adopted the Chicago Statement on Biblical Inerrancy as the end-all, be-all, and everybody that taught in any Baptist institution associated with the SBC had to agree to that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Among some of the things in there, the Bible is totally historically accurate in every word and in every detail. Semicolon. Provided that if the writers were not eyewitnesses, they were not given inappropriate or non-historical information. Wait a minute. You just said every word is historically accurate as it reads, and now you turn around and say, as long as if they weren't eyewitnesses, somebody gave them all the right information, they didn't give them an interpretation. All kinds of things. There are others as well. According to tradition, yes. However, we have no originals of anything written. No. We got copies of copies of copies of copies of copies. Oldest copies may be late 2nd century.
So the originals may have been in error, but the copies could have.
Right. Well, and some groups will say that they are totally inerrant in every way, not just historically, but they will even say scientifically in the original format. But then copyists make mistakes here and there.
Tell me what the Dead Sea Scrolls are. The Dead Sea Scrolls. I never understood this exactly. I don't
think it's found on
there anything, but you kind of bring up something. I
think it's in that area. Who has the pair of handcuffs and the muzzle? Ed just told me, talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls, but don't expound on it. The Dead Sea Scrolls, found in 1947, contained copies. Well, up until that point, all translations that we had, modern translations of the Old Testament or Hebrew Scriptures, were based on the Masoretic text, which 5th to 9th centuries, group of scholars, biblical Hebrew was dying as the language. Biblical scholars were commissioned to put vowels in because biblical Hebrew was consonants only, no vowels. And so you had to know the language and know the stories to really understand. No punctuation either. So all the letters ran together, no chapter and verse divisions. Chapter and verse divisions are later phenomenon that was added, not by the church, not other things. And so they felt the text was too sacred to actually go in and stick letters in there. So they developed a series of dots and dashes and squiggly marks and all kinds of other things, 11 vowels and 52 accents. And they put them around the letters. It took 4 centuries to do it. They didn't live that long, but they passed it on to others. So my copy of the Hebrew Bible in my office is a Masoretic text. It's got the vowel pointings and accent marks. Everybody was fine with that. 1947, this fine, and you got all these
what did it say? I mean, was
well, it was Old Testament. And then the Dead Sea Scrolls, you find these things in the clay jars, and that eventually when scholars got to looking at them, they said, uh-oh, no vowels, all consonants, which means these are Masoretic texts, 5th century A.D. Dead Sea Scrolls were written and collected no later than mid-1st century A.D., but probably 1st century B.C. or beyond. So they're 5 or 6 centuries older. And people said, what if when these are translated, we find out what we've been reading is wrong? And so Dead Sea Scrolls, actually there are multiple copies of every Old Testament book, said Pastor, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, plus other things. But they found out that there were some differences in the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Masoretic text, but nothing that made a big change in theology. There were minor things, pronoun here and there, and verb tense here and there, and those kinds of things. So the Dead Sea Scrolls then became the standard by which you judge the rest of the texts, and by which we now make translations of the Old Testament.
39 books or whatever the Old Testament
was? There were multiple copies of the 39, plus there were other things in there too. Copper scroll, war scroll, Book of Discipline for the Qumran community.
Genesis, Exodus, Psalms,
yes, and multiple copies of most of those. Minimum of 2. Some people are still trying to do it, but for the most part, a lot of years to do it.
So most of the theological discoveries or differences have to do with punctuation, because I've heard this bit. When Christ was on the cross, he turned to the thief and he said,
right.
Philosophy.
Right,
if
it does.
Say, I tell you this day,
comma,
you will be with your Father in heaven. That means
you will be with me in paradise. Yes.
I tell you this day, you will be with my Father in paradise. Right. Therefore, there can be purgatory. It doesn't tell you when, but if you say, I tell you, comma,
this day,
you will be with my Father in paradise, then you believe you directly ascend to heaven. So if there were no commas, then where the comma was placed had to do with what the theology of the editor,
the theology of the person that was reading it. And by the way, in the Greek text, with exception of a question mark, every so often, most of the Koine Greek was written. And it did have vowels, but there were no chapter verse divisions, no spaces between the words, and there were not commas.
Because I've seen students argue over that, and their Bibles, it depends on what Bible you have.
Right.
Right. You can support your argument
right.
for purgatory. But if you say, I tell you
or,
this day, then you can support that you go straight to heaven.
Right. Or one of the other things, Susan, that has come, that you're right where the comma goes, and I tell you this day, comma, or I tell you, comma, this day, you will be with me in paradise is what the text actually says. So, wait a minute. If it's I tell you, comma, this day you will be with me in paradise, but I thought Jesus didn't go up to paradise and come back again, but waited around. Then you've got another issue that bubbles up. Or I tell you this day, comma, you will be with me in paradise, which means the thief could go on. If you hold that doesn't necessarily mean the thief could go on while Jesus does what he does and then is resurrected and sees him in paradise. So well, there are there are all kinds of examples, humorous examples, and some that I've been told that can't be told in mixed company, depending on where you put the comma, on those kinds of things. But it is very, very important to try and understand those. So, doctrines of inerrancy, methods of interpretation. Do you interpret it literally? Which then probably means you've got an inerrancy doctrine that says every comma, every period, etc. And I love to get, when I'm in the right mood, I love to get folks, and I'm not putting it down. King James has beautiful English, beautiful poetry. It has a purpose in liturgy especially. But I love to get hold of somebody who says it's King James 1611 only, which you can't buy anymore anyway. Everything you buy is based on the fifth revision in the late 1700s. But King James 1611 only, two things I like to ask them. First of all, I like to ask them how they use the Apocrypha, because the Apocrypha was in the original. And then after they stop their conniption fits. Secondly, I like to talk about the italicized words, and you'd be surprised how many people do not know that in the King James Version, if a word appears in italics, there is no corresponding word in the Greek or Hebrew text. The translators put it in there, and they put it in italics to let you know they put it in there so that it read more smoothly. And I actually have, a number of years ago, I was sitting in a service where a guy was visiting, and the guy stood up and he was talking about the italicized words, and they were the points in his sermon. They were italicized because God wanted us to pay attention to them. And you don't know how badly I wanted to stand up and raise my hand and say, hold on, time out, but that wasn't the place. So I had to sit on my hands and squirm. So, you know, there are all kinds of things. Some use modern criticism, that is, and I don't mean poking holes at the Bible or tearing it down, but critical tools, literary criticism, historical criticism, those kinds of things. Sources. What are the sources and who used whom? And there are others who are like the guy that I've used the joke many, many times about the young preacher that came in, first sermon, had his notes and all, an old retired preacher in the congregation came up to him after and said, son, you got to let the Spirit, you got to let the Spirit move you. You don't use notes and all. And he was trying to explain, and he said, tell you what, the young man said, tell you what, you preach for me next Sunday, and I want to sit out there and take notes and observe because I really want to learn. He was all puffed up. Said, that's great. He gets up in his pulpit. He opens the Bible, puts his finger down, and said, Judas went and hanged himself. And he said, well, you know, it's not Easter, and I can't preach on that. So he closes it again. He opens it up, puts his finger down, and says, go thou and do likewise. You know, so there are people who function that way, and there are others who do the research and do the reading and all those kinds of things. And all of those, and many points in between, are in Baptist churches and Baptist life. What about baptism? Immersion in general. In general, Baptist churches agree in immersion. But a lot of Baptist churches divide over who the proper candidate is. Some, anybody that walks in says they believe. Others, got to go through a class. Some put age limits and some don't. Interestingly enough, where Baptist churches typically do not baptize, you know, they talk about, you know, no pedo baptism. That's child baptism, infant baptism. In some churches, the age is getting lower and lower and lower and lower and lower, and you got 5-year-olds being baptized. Well, in the Gospels, in the Gospels, you've got baptism, and the word is baptizo, which means to, in Greek, which means to immerse, to dip under, or to wash thoroughly. But as the church developed, there were all kinds of different methods that were used. And by the way, some require immersion, even for those that come from a Christian tradition that baptizes by another method, require immersion. Some immerse new believers only and accept previous baptisms from other traditions. And interestingly enough, John Smith and Thomas Helwys, to whom we trace our Baptist heritage in the early 1600s, baptized by pouring. They didn't immerse, they poured. They came out of the Church of England with its sprinkling. And they poured, in part based on some things with Menno Simons, who started the Mennonites, some of the Anabaptists, the rebaptizers that were around, and some others. Baptists divide over all kinds of things.
Is there a division over baptism versus
rebaptism? In some instances, yes, there's over baptism versus rebaptism. And some people, as I've said before, one of my daughter-in-law's sisters been baptized at least three times, maybe four. One in the Baptist church in which she grew up was baptized shortly before teenage years, And at least twice, if not three times, in pool baptisms, mass baptisms, on Highway 81 in Anderson. Because she was told that if she sinned and didn't feel right with God, then her first baptism didn't take. Of course, then I kind of wondered when I found out the third time. I said, well, wait a minute, did their second baptism of you not take? You know, that, but there are those with rebaptism. There are those, I've told the story where my best friend in high school, he and his wife, he was barely raised Methodist. She was raised Methodist, but they weren't all that regular. When they got married, you know, didn't want to have anything to do with it. Lo and behold, when their son was born, all of a sudden they wanted their son to be raised in church. So they started looking around. They couldn't find a Methodist church near them that they really liked. So they started looking at Baptist churches. They found one they really liked. And he called me up one day and he was very, very upset because that Baptist preacher said, even though he had been baptized in a Methodist church, said, you got to be immersed here or you can't be accepted. And he said, well, and he said this, he questioned it, and this minister said, no, your first baptism was not valid because you were not immersed. And so there is that whole thing. And for him, well, it is an outward sign of an interchange, and that, and you're uniting with the church. But Barry, yeah.
He didn't require you to do that to be a member of the church.
Yeah. Yes. But Barry. Historically. There are some who do think baptism saves you. But Barry, my friend Barry, said what he's saying to me is my baptism was not valid, and I've been living this, you know, sinful life all this time, even though I was baptized. He said that's not his decision to make. Eventually they did find a Methodist church about 20 miles away from their home that they liked, and they started going there, and I was glad for that. But right, which is 12, and that's where that's what a lot of people say. Age of accountability is 12.
Complicated decision.
Well, you've got that, and then you've got within Judaism, bar mitzvah was around 12 to 13, and so those things together put, that's why people presumed that was the age of accountability. Yes, Robert?
Well, I don't understand what difference it makes about the baptism, because that's joining the church.
Right.
It's not being saved.
But in this particular instance, that Baptist preacher indicated that he had not been, that Barry had not been saved. But that was one of those Baptists that said baptism is necessary. Within basic, though there are some differences and offshoots within basic Roman Catholic teaching, you must be baptized with the Spirit and water baptism is necessary. And that's why the children, that plus to protect them until they reach the age where they can be confirmed.
I often felt that they really make decisions on their own at that young. Can they make decisions how they want to feel at that age? You know, it's tough to be. It would be.
I have a question about the multiple baptisms, because there's only one church that I know of, that's the one you referred to, that will baptize people over and over.
There are others out there, but that's the... Well, it is a vain repetition, but what I would, and I have, and there are some other churches that I have known about in the past that did multiples, and I said basically what they're more Jewish than they are Christian, because within Judaism you had the mikvah, and when you, and they're more Essene, Qumranian, because in the Qumran community, the ones that had the Dead Sea Scrolls, in the Qumran community, if you committed a variety of sins, once you confess them, then you went and dipped yourself in the mikvah. And then you tried not to do that again. And the next time you sinned and you confessed it, you went and dipped yourself in the mikvah. And the next time you went and dipped yourself in the mikvah, the ritual bath, you're kind of washing it away. And so the multiple, a lot of these multiple baptisms, I think, really are more Essenic and Judaism with the rites of purification than they are Christian. Because, you know, John's baptism, John baptized and people didn't get baptized again from John. Paul only baptized a few, they didn't get baptized again.
Doesn't that church advertise how many baptisms they do?
Yes. But, well, redos are counted. Redos are counted among them. And I didn't mean to run so long, but among other things, theology. Our theology as Baptists range from Arminian with General Baptists to Calvinist with the particular Baptists in the 1630s and a lot of points in between. Regenerate church membership. Some people, there are churches out there that would say only if you have had a dramatic conversion are you really Christian. And then there are others, it's less dramatic. You're nurtured into the faith and come to the point where you make that decision. Landmark Baptist churches, which were predominantly in some places, Oklahoma, Texas, and a few other places in the 1800s, Landmark Baptist churches, if you were not, and there's still a few around, if you were not baptized by a Landmark Baptist preacher who was baptized by a Landmark Baptist preacher who was baptized by a Landmark Baptist preacher all the way back to John the Baptist, then your profession and your baptism meant nothing. So, you know, you got local church autonomy, priesthood of the believers, which is not just individual, but believers are never believers alone. They're bound together in a covenant community. Religious liberty. Where do we come up with all of these traditions? How do we get to this point, and why do we do the things that we do? So, that being said, and I thank you all for your questions and for your input, if you want to continue to do this, show up next Sunday night. And we'll start looking at, in particular, at Baptist, how Baptist traditions about Scripture and the Bible, and how those are alike and how they're dissimilar. Anything else for the good of the cause? Well, if, I mean, we may talk some about different denominations as well, okay. But we'll focus initially on the different kinds of Baptists. Okay. Well, thank you all. Be careful. God bless you and go in peace. And I hope to see you again soon.